How is everybody? Good. Well, welcome to our session. We are going to have some conversation around developing assessment capable learners. And somebody asked me when they first walked in, can we really do that? Yes, it just takes a little bit of time and purpose and being intentional and purposeful. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we can embed in our teaching and learning and making sure that we're doing it in a purposeful way and that we're intentional. It's kind of the same thing that we were talking about earlier in terms of your balanced assessment system. Just because you have a bunch of strategies that are just in a pile like your bricks doesn't mean you necessarily have an assessment system, right? And so just because we have a lot of strategies that we use with kids, if we don't use them strategically and in the right manner, oftentimes we just are doing a bunch of strategies and we may not be able to develop assessment capable learners, but we can if we're strategic and we think about it. So today is just kind of setting the foundation of what that could look like. And we're going to be engaging in some conversation, so hopefully you're sitting next to somebody that you like or looks halfway intelligent, and if not, you're going to have to get up and move, right, because we are going to have some conversation. This is my fifth session this time, and I figured by now my voice would be so tired I wouldn't want to talk a lot anymore, and I was going to have you guys do most of the work, so, which is what you need to do if you want to develop assessment-capable learners, right? Talk less and let them do more. So my name is Ellen Vorenkamp, and I am an assessment consultant at Wayne Risa. And this is my life, talking with our districts. We have 33 districts and about 100 plus charter schools in the Wayne County. And I do a lot of work in many of those school districts, schools and charters, talking with teachers about assessment capable learners and really helping them think about their assessment systems and if they're using quality assessments to make judgments about kids and so on and so forth. So I'm also a member of the MAC, I'm also a member of FAME, and I'm also a member of the committee that puts this organization, this conference together. So it's a pleasure to be here with you. So we're going to start out with a question, and so this is where you're going to need to be next to somebody. And our opening reflection is simply, this never works, I don't know why I even try to use them, is one, what does it mean to be assessment capable? So I want to activate your knowledge and just kind of start to think about, if a teacher is assessment capable, what does that actually mean that that teacher knows, understands, and can do? All right? So take a minute and turn to a partner and have some conversation around that. Okay, give you maybe about one more minute to finish up your last thought. Okay, please pause. So by a raise of hands, how many of you are teachers in the classroom? And how many of you that have your hands up and are teachers in the classroom consider yourselves assessment capable? Kind of, sort of? Getting there, maybe? All right. So what are some of the things that make you think that, and probably are, assessment capable? Nice. So having a real awareness of the different types of assessments and how we use those assessments, and then making sure that you have an awareness of where your students are in relation to those assessments. That kind of summarize? And I have to do that because the video, so bear with me as I practice my cognitive coaching and my summarization skills, which are not grand. But Matt, what would you add to the conversation?
Well, I'm just being, as a teacher, being able to assess the data that the assessor is giving you and knowing what to do with that data.
Nice. Good. So making sure that the data is actually usable, right? And making sure you're using it for the right purpose and making sure you're using it to further the kids would be my guess, right? To move the kids along, right? Good. Anybody else? What else does it mean? How many of you are principals? When you go into classrooms and you see a teacher that you would consider to be assessment capable, what do you look for? What do you see as they go? Not following a pacing guide? Yep. Good. Good. Okay, anybody else? At a different higher level, what does it mean to be assessment capable? Any other thoughts?
I'll go from a different perspective.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Which really helps with reliability, right? If we're talking a large scale assessment or like a common assessment, making sure that everybody's kind of giving it in the same way, right? So that your reliability becomes a little bit more steady. Good. All right, so now take that thinking and think about students. And what would you think, and what does it mean for a student to be assessment capable? Because in our first conversation, we were talking a lot about what the teacher is doing, with the assessments and understanding of the assessments and the use of the assessment data, how does this translate into the students? You heard Jim Pellegrino talk a little bit about students being involved in the process, right? So what does it mean for a student to be assessment capable? And go ahead and turn to that same partner, and I'll give you a couple minutes just to think about that. What might they be doing, and what might they be engaging in that would let they were assessment capable?
And some of you may have read their book about that.
Okay, about one more minute. All right, please pause. So what came up in this conversation in terms of what activities or what characteristics would we see in a child if we thought that they might be assessment capable themselves? So even having some conversation with them about what is assessment, right? And that they would be able to articulate that pretty much everything you're doing in your classroom is an assessment of sorts, right? So every time a teacher asks a question, they're recognizing that they're being assessed because the teacher wants to hear where they're at and what misconceptions they might have. So having an awareness of, and even maybe an awareness between the difference between assessment and test, right? Because they're kind of different things. Assessment is much broader, where a test is a type of assessment. That might be there. What else? Yeah, I thought you had your hand up. Right. Okay. So they take it as part of the learning process, right? Not always the end, but part of the learning process and showing what they know and where they need to grow, right, to help move themselves forward. That's big. You had your hand up. Yeah. Yeah. Which brings to my mind the whole culture of the classroom and how that is allowed and how that's part of the learning process. And, you know, I don't know number one yet, but I will get there eventually, you know, and allowing it to be more of a learning process than just a gotcha. Yeah, definitely. One more.
Yeah. I was just thinking the students need to have the stamina.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And not just on tests, but on all assessments. Like, if your assessment happens to be, you know, if the kids can write a research paper, that requires a little bit of stamina, right? It's not a necessarily difficult task, but it takes some stamina. And oftentimes, kids won't engage in things that are actually quite simple, but take a lot of time and effort because they don't have that stamina, right? All right, so the things that we're talking about today are all going to be embedded in what we're going to have some conversation around. This is all based on a book. It's called Developing Assessment-Capable Visible Learners by John Hattie, Douglas Fisher, and Nancy Fry. And in this book, they set forth a couple of characteristics that they believe students need to get engaged in order to become assessment-capable. And under each of these big categories, they have some characteristics and then some strategies that teachers could put into place when they're actually developing assessment-capable learners. Because one of the things that they will talk about is we oftentimes do not have these kids just show up at our door, right? These are things that we have to engage with kids around, and there are activities that we can do in our classrooms that will help us develop these assessment-capable learners. And ironically, there is a really tight correlation between what they're talking about and the formative assessment process. So if any of you have been involved in formative assessment, you're going to see some correlations here. But we're going to start off with just the first part, and this is a webinar that they have. We're not going to watch the whole thing, but I want you to hear just the first beginning piece of it when Doug is talking just a little bit about one of his experiences. And based on that, we're going to set the stage for what an assessment-capable learner could be. Now, as you listen to this, I'm pretty sure that Nancy and Doug are at home, and it might be cocktail hour. I'm not 100% sure. But you hear some tinkling of ice and some pouring of some something and a little bit of chewing, right? So the beginning is a little bit rough, but you can still hear what and you can get the gist of his story. But if you hear, you know, a little tinkling of ice, that's not me having a cocktail. That would be Doug having a cocktail while he's talking about this.
So. Today, they are here to talk about their newest work with John, developing assessment-capable visible learners. Welcome, Doug and Nancy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are very happy to be here to talk about, for the first time, our newest project, our newest collaborative effort. and that is assessment capable learners, or in the more technical, assessment capable visible learners. And I thought we'd start with a story from my background. Several years ago, I decided to go back to school and learn about the human brain. I was very interested in the brain and what implications it had for us as teachers and for learners. And so I enrolled in a class Thursday nights at 9 o'clock, or 7 o'clock till 9:40 at night, and very excited about it. I bought the book. It came to my house a few days later, and it said, "Somites are blocks of dorsal mesodermal cells adjacent to the notochord during vertebrate organogenesis." I am now a struggling reader. You might be a struggling reader too when you see that sentence. And it just reminds me that struggle is situational, that we create situations in which learners struggle or don't struggle. They can be successful. So I'm a struggling reader, so I decide, you know, I'm going to close that textbook. It's the summer. I'm going to show up on the first night of class, and my teacher's going to teach me. About halfway through the first night of class, my teacher said to the whole class, "I don't know how you're going to learn this, but it's on the test." I showed up not knowing how I was going to learn the content. Now my teacher doesn't know how I'm going to learn the content. You can imagine the problems in our relationship. So I'm thinking I should have dropped out. But I was too embarrassed to drop out because I told everyone at Health Sciences High, where Nancy and I work, I told everyone that I was taking this brain class. So I'm thinking about what to do. And the next day I talked to a biology teacher at our school, and he offers to loan me the 10th grade biology book. And I can read that 10th grade book. I can read that biology book because it's written at the 10th grade level, and there's about 65 pages on the central nervous system. And there I am reading that book, and I'm learning about lobes and hemispheres and blood supply and all this cool stuff. And for the next week in class, for about 15 minutes, I was right there with my teacher. I don't know what she talked about for the rest of the 2 hours, but for that 15 minutes, it felt amazing. And I thought a lot about this. When you struggle, and then you get it and you recognize that about yourself, it's pretty powerful and it's pretty amazing. I was so motivated that night that I pulled over on my way home and stopped at a bookstore. And I went through the shelves and I found this book. And this book had a lot of good basic information to help me understand the brain. Then I found this book on Amazon one night looking for more things to read. And I love the title. I think the author has to be super brave because there's a lot of pressure to say your book is Clinical Neuroanatomy Made Ridiculously Simple, Interactive Edition. And this author has DVDs and very helpful. That semester, I watched over 100 YouTube videos. I bought the 5-DVD Secret Life of the Brain. I went on the internet and quizzed myself almost every week. And I would talk to anyone who would listen to me talk about the brain. The midterm comes. It's 17 pages long, single-spaced, 200 multiple-choice questions. I worked very, very hard on that midterm. It was on a text that I could not read, but I got a B-plus on that midterm. And besides some neuroanatomy, I think I learned a few things about myself as a learner. You can't independently learn from books you cannot read, but you can learn. I ended up with a B-plus on that midterm, never having read the assigned textbooks, because reading a lot, reading widely builds background knowledge and vocabulary. And interacting with other people keeps me motivated, clarifies understanding, and extends my learning. There wasn't a single time in my class where my teacher said, "Turn to your partner and talk," or "As a group, process this." Not a single time, but I know better. So every Monday, I would send an email out to the 17 other people enrolled in the class, and I would invite them to meet me at dinner at 5 o'clock before our class started at 7 o'clock. So that we could have time to talk to each other about the things we were learning, the things we were reading, and the things our teacher was teaching us. So I wonder, based on that, do you think I was an assessment-capable learner? In other words, did I understand my current level of performance? Did I know learning goals and success criteria? Did I select appropriate learning strategies? Did I accept the challenge? Did I seek feedback and recognize errors? Did I monitor my own progress? And did I recognize my own learning and then teach others?
All right, so what do you think? Do you think Doug understood his current level of understanding as he was taking this neuroanatomy class? Yeah, he definitely knew what he didn't know, right? Right, which is sometimes as important, if not more important, in knowing what than knowing what you do know, right? So he knew what he didn't know, and he knew that he couldn't read the book, and he knew he needed to find something else. Do you think he knew the learning goals and success criteria?
Yes.
Explain.
I would say if it was a college course, your learning goals should be outlined.
Okay, so there's an assumption there that the teacher had done that?
There's an assumption, yes. At the collegiate level.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that may be inherent in that assumption.
I didn't feel the same way, though.
No?
I didn't feel the same way because I guess I put it back on myself. Okay, what would have I done? We've all had that college class, right? You open the book and what, so then you look for other ways to learn that stuff. But how do you know where you're supposed to be at?
Yeah.
How do you know if you're learning, on task with what? You can't read the textbook. How do you know where you're supposed to be and how do you know what you're supposed to be learning?
Yep. There's another. And if the teacher on the first night says, I don't know how you're going to learn this, so good luck. That's kind of like maybe a red flag going up. I'm not sure. Yeah. Yeah. That one's kind of questionable. Appropriate learning strategies and accepting the challenge. Do you think he did that?
Yeah.
Definitely. That was probably his biggest success, right? He knew what he didn't know, and he knew that he needed to find a different way to do it, so he went and got some of those resources. Seek feedback and recognize errors. Probably somewhere along the way, maybe not quite as clear. Monitor his own progress, maybe against his own learning, right? Might have been a little bit more difficult in terms of the success criteria because he wasn't exactly maybe sure, unless it was very well outlined in the syllabus. Mm-hmm. With his colleagues.
Yeah, when you're meeting with your colleagues and assuming that they're reading the book, that's kind of like the self-check.
Could be, yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you are where you should be through your conversation, are y'all hitting the same point, so on and so forth, for both points that you just did.
Yeah, yeah. So, but he took that upon himself, right? Never once were they asked to turn and learn, right? Which is kind of an interesting concept, which I had a couple of probably university classes like that. But hopefully that's not happening in our K-12 system. All right, so keeping that in mind, and because I couldn't buy everybody a copy of the book, we're going to read a quick little article that they developed prior to publishing their book. So, whenever somebody's got a brand new book, they always publish an ASCD and Ed Leadership. So this is just kind of a synopsis of the book. And it talks a little bit about why this is important and how it can really help with motivation and engagement and giving kids good feedback and things like that. So I want you just to take a minute and read through this article. And if there's anything that you find to be intriguing, just highlight it or underline it. And we're going to have a quick conversation around it here in a few minutes. I'll give you about 8 minutes, I guess, to read. Did everybody get a copy? All right, so what I'd like you to do now, and if you're not completely done, that's okay. You've probably read enough of it. I need you to find somebody that's in the room, and we're going to stand up. So find somebody in the room that has a similar color shirt on as you, potentially. And if not, maybe go, just kind of a similar pattern or something like that. And just have a conversation with maybe somebody that you haven't been sitting next to around one or two big ideas that may have come to you as you were reading through that article, and feel free to move a little bit and get the blood flowing yet again. You do, you do. Kind of stripes, maybe. We're just sharing, so if you want to get with somebody or share with yourself, however you feel like. Okay, well, maybe that's what you might want. All right, go ahead and thank your partners and sort of head back to where you were sitting. Yeah. Thank you guys for being open to moving around a little bit. I appreciate that. So in your conversations and thinking about these six big ideas in terms of what assessment-capable learners do was there anything that rose in terms of your conversations around, is this really possible, or those kind of things? What may have come out? We'll compare with them here in a few minutes.
I looked at it through an elementary line, an early elementary line, and I was fortunate enough to be paired with somebody who looked at it through high school then.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had some good conversation about motivation and self-regulation being key to these humans that know things, but
don't always show us the thing. Right. Good. So thinking about that motivation and that self-regulation, and how do we purposely teach kids to engage in those types of activities, especially as they get older and become, I'm guessing older, and become a little more impulsive, just thinking about my own children and when I taught middle school and how impulsive they were. And then our expectations and how we can teach them, you know, these things. What else may have come into your conversations? Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree 100%. And they have that stamina for all of those types of things. If it gets difficult, they'll bear right through it, you know, if it's something that they're passionate about. And sometimes, sitting in your Algebra 1 class, you're thinking, wait a minute, I see you out on the basketball, you know, with that, why, you know. And so we have to help them recognize that they are actually putting forth very specific strategies, right? And they're doing very specific metacognitive processes while they're there. And even though you may not be as passionate about Algebra 1, if you bring some of those strategies into this classroom, and if I as a teacher help you develop those within my classroom, you can get better, right? You may not still be the best or whatever, but you can get better, right? And so it's thinking about how we transfer some of these strategies and skills, and as we as teachers purposely start to help the students develop them.
The feedback's often immediate.
Huge. It's always immediate, right? Yeah. Move your hand, you know, hold the racket differently.
Yep. Another area too is video games. Like,
absolutely.
You know, oh, I died. What am I going to do next time? And you go forth and you see some of the kids, in particular our adolescent young men, who like can sit in front of Call of Duty for hours and get better, you know, but when it comes to Algebra 1, I'm done, shut down.
Yep. And you know, interestingly enough, I think, in my opinion, I love that analogy with the video games because two things come to mind. When they do die, they don't always have to go back to level one, right? They can start where they left off, so to speak, and start over again, right? So it's not like they have to redo everything like we sometimes make them do in our classrooms. And two, even though they may die, whatever, they don't get a grade while they're still learning how to play the game. And so when I think about what Tom Gusky was talking about yesterday and the way that we sometimes put grades on everything and some of it is still while the learning is being developed, that might truncate some of these other strategies and things that we're trying to get the kids to engage in. I remember telling my kids, you know, we've all read the book Growth Mindset and how we praise kids and all that kind of stuff, and telling my students, you know, this is really important work. I want you to take your time. It really needs to be done well. But it's due tomorrow, right? Because I have this deadline, right? So we have all these systems in place that can sometimes can get in the way of some of the strategies that Nancy Fisher and Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry talk about in their book. So what I want you to do, was there anything else before I move on that anybody might have lifted? That's a great conversation. I really appreciate your volunteering to contribute. So what we're going to do is you have a white sheet. And what I really want you to do is take a minute and think about, in our classrooms, if we're taking the analogy of having the kids in the video games and we can see that perseverance and grit and that self-regulation and things like that, or when they're out on the sports field, what could a teacher do in their classroom to engage kids, right, so that they are aware of their current level of understanding, so that they do understand their pathway and are confident enough to take on the challenges, that they can select tools and resources to guide their learning, that they seek feedback and recognize errors or opportunities to learn. What do we do within our classroom that allows kids to monitor their own progress and learn from their mistakes? And what do we do in terms of helping kids teach one another and setting that environment where there's not one teacher in the classroom, but if there's 30 kids, there's 31 teachers in that classroom? So what can a teacher do very strategically, and how can they engage kids in what kind of activities to actually help develop these six characteristics of assessment-capable learners? And what I want you to do is get with a partner again, and you can group yourselves any way you want to. You can do, I actually had large sheets that I was going to have you be in groups, but since we never have tables at these things, it becomes very troublesome. So I went and copied the smaller sheets. Get together with maybe three or four people and just start to fill out what are some of the strategies or purposeful activities that you would engage kids in as the teacher to actually develop these six characteristics. And I'm going to give you about 10 minutes to explore and think about this. And then I'm going to tell you what the authors say. And so you can compare your thinking to theirs, and maybe you can add some ideas, and maybe you can share with us some of your ideas that might be better than what the authors come up with, right? So I'll give you about 10 minutes to explore and have a conversation with each other. Might there be any questions? Okay, all right. All right, please pause. And you're welcome to stay where you're at. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a slide. There's six of them, one for each of the different characteristics of assessment-capable learners. And I'm just going to explain a couple of them. And then I want to make the tie-in to how it really connects with formative assessment. And then we're not going to take the time to do that, but this is actually the rest of the article that kind of highlights some of these practices. But if you really want to get a deep dive into it, you really need to read the book, because they've got all kinds of ideas and suggestions. They've got all kinds of templates that you can use, and there are lots of wonderful little video vignettes that you can click on to actually see teachers engaging students in many of these strategies. Okay, and I'm not here to sell their book, but it's just a really good resource. So here we go. The first one really has to do with clarity, right? The students need to understand their learning path and then be confident enough to take on that challenge. So that means we have to have learning goals. We have to let the kids know what the purpose of today's lesson is. By the end of today, I need you to be able to do whatever, and this is what success on it looks like. I will know you're proficient on this if I can see you do this, this, and this. So learning goals, success criteria are huge. And it is not simply enough to put them on the board for compliance because your observation tool says that you need to. It's about really embedding them in the teaching and learning process and making sure that every task and activity that you have the kids engaged in are relating back to that learning goal and that success criteria, and they can see that alignment. They can see that correlation. They talk a little bit about the use of exemplars and how exemplars or examples of quality work can be very helpful, especially in relation to that success criteria. And of course, if the kids copy it, you say, well, that's a wonderful job copying it. Now you're going to do it again, and you're going to do it in your own way now that you've had this practice, right? Because we know that some kids will do it exactly like the exemplar is. But creating exemplars together, or taking an example of bad work and using your success criteria to work together and making it better, can be very powerful. Your classroom climate, they talk a lot about. They talk a little bit about Carol Dweck and the growth mindset piece and making sure that you have an environment where they do feel confident enough to take on the challenge. They even mention Angela Duckworth in her book around grit and perseverance. And I love what you said earlier, because oftentimes we talk to kids like they have no grit and they have no perseverance. Well, I taught in inner city Detroit, and I taught in inner city El Paso. Let me tell you, my kids had grit and they had perseverance because they were dealing with things that I never even my mind could comprehend. And yet for some reason, we think they don't have it when they come in the classroom. And sometimes it's just that we don't allow them to use it, right? And we need to help them develop it in a positive way within those classroom walls. So the classroom climate is huge. And then what you were talking about too, that stamina and rigor piece, right? I know that a lot of people think rigor is a four-letter word, but it's not. And it doesn't mean more. It just means making sure that we are constantly keeping kids, each individual child, right at the edge of their competence, right? Because formative assessment and developing assessment-capable learners is about nudging kids along and making sure that they're always growing. We can't allow the top to be static, we can't allow the middle to be static, and we can't ignore the lower-end kids. So we have to make sure that we are giving the appropriate amount of rigor to the right kids, and we have to make sure that we're actually doing assignments that make them have to do a little bit of the STAMA. If you watch the webinar, they've got a really nice graphic in there about how they talk about rigor and stamina and how they put it all together, so it's well worth watching. So clarity is really important, and you'll notice that I have it in red, and there's a purpose for that, and I'll show you that in a minute. Okay, the next thing, what else did you guys have? Did you guys have anything else that they didn't talk about? Did you have all that stuff too? No? Okay. Well, that's all right. What about the next one? They're aware of their current level of understanding in a learning area. How'd we do? What were some of your ideas on that one? All right, well, I'm just going to tell you what they say because it's almost time for lunch, and I don't want to be the last person there like we were yesterday. All right. When they are aware of their current level of understanding within a learning area, that means that we do some sort of pre-assessment, but we don't keep the pre-assessment for ourselves. I remember as a teacher that I gave my kids pre-assessments, and then I used the information to figure out what I needed to teach and where I needed to go next, and I don't recall ever giving it back to them anywhere during the learning so that they could actually gauge how much more they had learned and where they were at and what that growth was looking like. So self-assessment is really important in this one as well, but using your pre-assessment as a self-assessment can actually be very powerful. Because when kids start to recognize that at the beginning I didn't know all this stuff, but now, you know, 2 days in, I'm beginning to understand it and I'm beginning to learn it, that's motivating. That's them showing each other that growth and having those conversations and feeling better about themselves. Conferencing is huge. And they don't mean about having long 10-minute conferences. They mean being up, walking around as your students are involved in tasks, and just speaking with kids every now and then and asking them a really pointed question that's focused on your learning targets and your success criteria. How is it going? What are you thinking? What might you need? How can I help you? Might you have any questions? Very targeted, very focused, very in the moment types of conferencing. That's not the type of thing where you would need, somebody else in the room because you're having these really deep conversations with the kids up at the front of the room. This is embedded in the learning. One that they talk about is really interesting to me is gauging task difficulty. And for this one, it kind of goes back to the stamina. But they say that when you are actually giving the kids a task, that you should allow them to take a minute and reflect on how difficult they think that task is going to be to complete. And that difficulty could be in terms of the content, or it also could be in terms of the effort that they're going to have to put forth. And that could be as simple as getting just a half sheet of paper and having a 4-3-2-1, 4 being this is going to be really hard for me to do, 2-3-1, this is going to be really easy for me to do, and allowing them to actually decide where they're at. And if you have a lot of kids that are in that 4, then you conference with them. Why is this going to be difficult? What's standing in your way? How can we remove those obstacles? And actually start to have some questioning around why they're viewing this as a very difficult thing. That will help build your stamina, and it'll also help them start to self-assess not only the task, but the self-regulation that's involved in completing that task. And then the last thing, of course, is asking the right questions at the right time to make sure that you're really getting at their thinking, and then modeling those questions so that they start asking themselves those questions when you're not there to prompt them. Because we really need kids who are metacognitive, and when they come up with an obstacle, they really need to be able to say, where do I need to go to next, without the teacher being the one there that has to spoon feed them. So think about those first two, turn to a partner and just ask if there's anything in there that was new to them or anything that just was an aha, and then we'll move on to the next 4 real quick. But just take a break for a second, turn what struck you within these first two that are kind of related. All right, we're going to move on to the third one, which is actually the fourth one on your sheet. because I took a little bit of liberty with this and rearranged them a bit. Don't tell Fisher and Fry, I don't want to get in trouble. But to me, I think feedback comes next before we get into the whole metacognition piece. So this is your fourth box. They seek feedback and recognize that errors are opportunities to learn. So feedback is a loop, right? It has to involve the students. It is not a one-way street. It has to be descriptive and actionable. There is a whole lot of research. John Hattie, Paul Black, Helen Temperley have done volumes of research around feedback. And just telling the kids good job or giving them a B+ doesn't tell them anything about how well they did the task, what they need to continue to do, what they need to add to their repertoire. A B+ basically tells the child you did something well enough to get a B, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. You didn't do something well enough to get an A. Good luck figuring that out. So next time around, you'll probably get a B again. So feedback needs to be descriptive and actionable in relation to the learning goal and the success criteria. This is what you've done well. This is where you need to move forward. And it's not just about the task. Task is important, but you also have to talk to them about the process. What strategy did you use in order to get to this conclusion? What was your thinking while you were doing this? And get at some of the process pieces that are really important for kids to start to recognize that not everything in your classroom is a nail, so they can't, you know, approach it as if everything with a hammer, right? They have to start to think about their strategies and how they maneuver them. And then we also have to give them feedback about self-regulation. How did you monitor your work? If you thought this was really difficult in terms of gauging task difficulty, how did you break it down into smaller steps? How did that work for you? How did you find the resources that you needed? So on and so forth. And so feedback is not just about yes, no, right, wrong. It's about the process of learning. And then we have to model. We have to model how to give the feedback, because ultimately we want them to be able to give themselves feedback and then to be able to be resources for one another through peer feedback. So we have to model it, and most importantly, we have to give them time to use it. One of the things that I hear a lot from teachers that I work with in Wayne County is I gave all this feedback and they didn't do anything with it. It's like, well, did you give them the opportunity to do something with it? No. I told them to go home and try again and come back, you know, whatever. They're not going to do that. There's a great article, it was written by Grant Wiggins, and at the very end of it he says, and now after all this information that I've given you of feedback, if your attitude is still, I don't have time to give feedback, he says, then you do not have time to impact learning. Because feedback is learning, right? And then ultimately what you would want is for students to come up and ask you for feedback. Not for the answers, but for feedback. This is where I'm going. This is what I think I'm doing. This is a strategy I'm trying. Do you think this will? That's when you know you've got a truly assessment-capable learner in front of you. Okay? This is a poster that they talk about in the webinar. And it's that, have you asked for help? Did you receive help? Did you deny help? Because sometimes, you know, if you go up and ask a child, do you want some feedback? And they say, no, I want to struggle on my own. That's a good thing, right? What can I do to help you within your struggle to make sure that you don't, you know, implode? But where could we go next? I would have you turn and talk, but we got 7 minutes, and I really don't want to be the last ones to lunch. So I'm going to move on. Is that all right? Any questions? Okay. Metacognition piece, and this to me is the last couple of them. They can select tools and resources to guide their learning, right? So what we don't want is kids to sit there and say, what now? I don't understand this word. I can't move forward unless my teacher comes to me and gives me the definition of the word. We want them to be able to say, oh, I can go get a dictionary. Like Doug Fisher did when he didn't understand his textbook, he went and found other books. So we have to make our teaching moves very apparent. And by that, we mean anytime you're using any kind of strategy in your classroom to help kids think through, and you're thinking about the strategy, and you're thinking about, you talk it out loud. You talk to them about the strategy that you're using and how it's working and if it's not working, and you make your learning and the way that you're teaching those kids as apparent as you possibly can so that they can take that and kind of model that and replicate it when they're on their own and they come up against a struggle. So think alouds are huge. Modeling is huge. The question asking is huge. We want kids to set goals, because when we think about formative assessment, which this is all embedded in the formative assessment process, where are we at? Where do I need to go? So if I use these resources and I use these strategies and I can actually guide my learning, how am I going to do this in order to set this goal and then to actually achieve this goal? They talk a little bit about study skills, which is kind of interesting, because I remember when I taught, especially in El Paso back in the late on Earth, I did a lot around study skills with my kids. But I don't remember my own children, who have just all, you know, graduated, doing a lot of study skills. And I don't know if that's something that's kind of gone by the wayside because we have so much content that we have to cover. Notice I use the word cover, not necessarily learn, but we have to cover. That study skills is one of those things that's gone by the wayside. But teaching the kids study skills can be really impactful and help also make them assessment capable. So there are cognitive study skills, such as involving the task, like how they note take, how they summarize, things like that. There are metacognitive, which is the whole self-management and the planning. And I put summarizing again, but that's not summarizing. And then the affective study skills, like their motivation, their agency, their engagement, and if they're willing to keep trying. And then again, asking questions. Because the more questions they ask, the less we have to, right? And the more that we can see into their brains. Because it's a little more apparent when you're on the basketball field where the issues are than in an Algebra 1 math class if we can't get inside their heads. All right, last two, they monitor their own progress and adjust course as needed, self-assessment all over again, looking for their own growth related to their learning goals and success criteria. I am not a big fan of data walls. I don't think we need to publicly shame kids, and even though they may have secret codes and secret names and secret ID numbers, kids still know where they're falling, right? But I do think we should have data notebooks and every child keeping track of their own growth and self-assessing where they're at and where they need to go. We need to teach them problem-solving skills, and we need to model that for them, and we need to think aloud when we're solving problems with our groups and in our classrooms. Again, those think alouds can be really powerful. We need to help them think critically, and I think by doing all of these things, we're actually helping kids think critically. And we need to allow them to have time to reflect. I think reflection is probably the one thing we do the least amount of in our classrooms. And when you think about John Dewey, you guys remember John Dewey from back in the day? We don't learn from our experiences, we learn from reflecting on our experiences, right? That was his big quote. We all get in the car at the end of the day and we reflect back on our day and what worked and what didn't work. I can guarantee you that most of them, when they get on those buses or they get in their parent car, they are not reflecting on how well they did in your classrooms. They're thinking about what they're going to have for snack, right? Or all kinds of different things. So giving them that opportunity in class to do some reflection. And last but not least is the peer assessing and helping them become assessors for one another. So when you think about, and when they talk about it in the book, they talk about how it starts with feedback from the teacher. We engage kids in peer feedback, and we allow them to model what we're doing in the classroom with one another. And if we can do that really well, then they can actually start to do it for themselves and become self-assessors. Okay? But our goal also is to help them recognize that they can and learn from each other. And so that peer assessment, giving them opportunities to collaborate, helping them have those shared understandings and those shared responsibilities, which does not mean a shared grade or shared feedback. But we can, you know, that's another conversation to have. So you might have noticed as we were going through that there were different colors when we were talking about this. So you can't really tell it, but clarity is more red. This one happens to be more orange. This one, feedback, is yellow. And then the last three metacognitive pieces are blue and green. And the reason they are different colors is if you've done any work around formative assessment and you've read anything from Dylan Willem or Paul Black, who did the original formative assessment work, they talked about how there were five non-negotiables in terms of the formative assessment process. And those five things happen to be clarity, good questioning strategies that lead to good dialogue in the classroom, giving kids good feedback, helping kids become self-assessors, and helping kids become peer assessors. And those are five practices that are embedded deeply in the formative assessment process. And all of this book is based on the work of John Hattie. And in his book, Visible Learning, these were the top 13 strategies that John Hattie said had the highest impact on student achievement. And if you look at it, it's student expectations, which of course is clarity. It's classroom discussion, which is having dialogue. It's feedback. It's metacognitive strategies, self-verbalization, self-questioning, and problem solving. So everything that's in his book is based on his research and is embedded in the five non-negotiables, or the five big practices of formative assessment that are replicated in those five big things that Paul Black and Dylan Willem found. So if we really want to make sure that our students are assessment capable, thinking about and using the formative assessment practices in your classroom is going to take you there. So all of these strategies in and of themselves are great, but if we don't build them into a system of delivery, such as formative assessment can do for us, then they just become a bunch of strategies. And I go back to that analogy. Just because you have a pile of bricks doesn't mean you have a balanced assessment system or even a strategic assessment system. So take these strategies and put them into a system like formative assessment, and we can develop assessment-capable learners. Any thoughts, questions? If you want the last part of the article, because you can't buy the book yet, there's about 100 copies here, so help yourselves to a couple of them, because I don't really want to take them home. And thank you, guys. I hope you have a rest good of your conference.